Well, I forgot to give you some homework last night. That was, when you wake up in the morning, if you wake up in the morning, ha ha ha, let's check we all did wake up in the morning, that we'd go, oh my God, I'm still alive, I can't believe it. And you'll bliss out, and you'll go, I must leap out of bed and come to the class and listen to Buddha's teachings to take some tools away to develop my qualities so I can benefit sentient beings, because I didn't die today. So, but who did that? We didn't. Oh, groan, another day, you know, didn't we? So anyway, do we do it now? We'll think. Here we are, still alive, and we'll talk about this. As I said yesterday, one of the many misconceptions in this mind of ours that we totally take as the truth is that we believe we're permanent, even though intellectually it's a silly thing, but we feel it instinctively, grasping intensely. And so we need to counteract it. And the most simple way to counteract a misconception is with the opposite thought, you know. Slowly, slowly, you know, that begins to take power into our, take hold in our mind. So, okay, we think, here we are, still alive, meaning, perhaps we'll talk about this more, that our petrol tank of morality hasn't run out, basically. You know, we think we're alive because we're young or we're healthy. No, it's not the main reason. The main reason is because you've got in your petrol tank of morality is still an accumulation of virtuous imprints, you know. This is how Buddha would talk. So we delight in this. We delight, how amazing, I'm not dead yet. This precious human rebirth that I must have worked so hard to get. So why waste it? What a tragedy, you know. So wasting it means us to sort of, you know, wasting it. Well, we'll talk about it. So thinking, I don't want to waste it. I want to make the most of it. So I'm sitting here listening to these ideas of the Buddha to see if there's something useful that I can take into my life. That's the point, you know. It's got to be practical. Not just not intellectual ideas, just for the fun of it. Practical. So, and you use these tools to do what? Develop my amazing potential. Become the person I want to become. Become infinitely more than that, actually, as Buddha would say. And for my sake, but for sure, for everybody else's sake, because we all live in this insane asylum together. And if I don't help others, who will? Having the courage of the Bodhisattva, thinking like this. And we'll just sing the little prayer, the first two lines of which, for those of us who feel we are already Buddhist, that we're reiterating our reliance on the Buddha, his Dharma, and so on. And the second two lines expressing this altruistic motivation or reason for listening to these teachings.
Sangye charang sokhe chok nam la jangcho baru dagni khyab su chi dagi chernyen gi pe sonam ki drola penchir sangye drobha shok Sangye charang sokhe chok nam la jangcho baru dagni khyab su chi dagi chernyen gi pe sonam ki drola penchir sangye drobha shok Sangye charang sokhe chok nam la jangcho baru dagni khyab su chi dagi chernyen gi pe sonam ki drola penchir sangye drobha shok.
So for three or four quality minutes, let's just focus our minds, Focus our mind. And so it's helpful to focus on something, okay? It makes it easy to anchor the mind to something. So we'll just use that really simple object called the breath. So be very natural, very relaxed. Just close your eyes, keep your body nice and straight. Well, I'll just go through the main points of the classic way to sit that's most recommended by the meditators. And then we'll just do the 3 or 4 minutes focusing. So the ideal way to sit, it's got about 7 points, you know. The first one is to have the legs in what they call full lotus position. There's something that's found by all the great meditators, something very conducive about that position. All the subtler energies align very nicely. And also the body stays very stable, because if you're going to meditate a long time, you don't want to topple over, do you? You know, so it's very stable position. Of course, probably most of us can't sit in that position. We're not practiced, you know. So if you can have one leg up on the other thigh, that's good. Actually, His Holiness the Dalai Lama said, read, that to start your session in that position is really auspicious.
for the ability in the future to be able to do it, because in the more advanced practices, they say it's necessary, you know. So if we can, if not ordinary cross-legged, if not in our chairs, you know. But the key thing is to have the back nice and straight. So first is the legs, and next is the back. They talk about how you can imagine your spine like an arrow, and the coccyx pointing directly into the earth. That's the head of the arrow. Ramrod straight. But then the problem is, as soon as we sit up straight, we get everything tense. Our muscles are tense. So I like to think of the body like the skeleton hanging on a hanger. Completely straight, isn't it? Then all the soft bits hanging on it, very relaxed. So body upright, but then relax your muscles. Keep it upright, but then relax your muscles, especially the abdomen. We always squeeze that in. Your shoulders, very relaxed, but upright. Your shoulders, the third point, they say, to be, you know, like that, upright, not tense, not slouched, but nice and straight. The hands, many, many ways they do, but the classic position we're taught is like this, left underneath, like right on top, like this, and the thumbs forming a triangle, like this. And I've heard ages ago, I've never had an explanation, that the subtler channels related to bodhicitta, the tips of the thumbs. I don't know where I got that from. So don't take it as gospel truth. Maybe ask Google, they'll tell you the answer. Okay, that's then the legs, the hands, the back, the shoulders. Now the head, several points about the head. The first thing is have it slightly tilted forward. If you have it thrust back, it kind of makes the mind agitated. Slightly tilted forward, chin tucked in. Then the jaw, very relaxed, and even have your mouth, lips slightly apart. And then the tongue, the tip of the tongue, rest it behind the top teeth, just near the palate. We don't normally put it there, but apparently that's helpful to prevent you from dribbling too much or having to swallow the spit when you're meditating lots of, you know, for plenty of time. And breathing through your nose. Finally, the eyes. Again, having them up in your head like this is not helpful. It makes the mind agitated. So have your eyes down, as if you're looking along your nose at the ground. And all the meditators say, you know, when you're meditating a lot, including in the daytime, it's best to have your eyes open because the light comes in and keeps your mind sharp. But for most of us, probably, not good focus. So, you know, keep them closed, but have them looking down in your head as if you're looking along your nose. So this is the classic position that's been found to be most conducive for focusing the mind. So settle into this position, but then be very unself-conscious about it, because your mind, your body doesn't meditate, okay? And we get a very strong sense of a feeling of meditating. Oh, I'm sitting here meditating, getting all holy. It's not your body that meditates, okay? But your body needs to be in this conducive position to allow your mind to do the job. Your mind meditates. Okay, so just briefly now. This simple meditation, this focusing technique, which is the one coming and often known as mindfulness these days, you know, coming from the Hindus. They created this technique. They perfected it. And then Buddha took this and ran with it. And it's an absolutely crucial technique to accomplish for long-term results, you know. Perhaps we'll talk more about this today. We'll need to, yeah. So there's lots of... The thing is that we say, I... and meditating. We try to get a feeling of the I meditating. Well, let's be more precise, okay? Just like if you said, I am holding an apple, which part of you, Rabina? Oh, well, my hand. Which part of your hand? Well, my thumb does this, my index finger does that. You've got to be precise in understanding which part of the general you that does the job. So here, I indeed am watching my breath. Which part of I, Rabina? Well, it's my mind. Which part of my mind? Well, there's lots of bits there. Not talking brain, we're talking various thoughts. So many, many bits all play the role in doing something, like we were discussing with Lynn yesterday. So the key part here, we could say, is we're trying to train generally your mind, you can call it awareness, okay? So the part that's, we call the part that's focusing on the object, and the object will be the sensation at the tip of your nose as you breathe in and out. So first, before we describe, just briefly, before we do that, just locate that sensation. Just take a couple of really good deep breaths, not loud,
all the way down to your abdomen. Feel your abdomen moving, you know, horizontally, all the way down, in and out, but focus, locate that sensation at the tip of your nose. Couple of breaths. So it's not quite the tip, is it? It's the nostrils there. You feel it. You can locate, you can focus on anything you like. You can focus on your shoes if you wanted to. It's just that that's, too, you know, something inside here. And by the way, breath is still what they call an external object. It's still external, meaning physical. When your mind gets more subtle, there'll be no awareness of body at all. So it has to be finally the mind itself that one needs to use as our focus. That's the more advanced, you know. But we start with something simple like the breath. It arises naturally, so we anchor our minds to it. So, okay, that's the object. So now we can say that awareness, the general, the part we go, you know, your mind is going, I'm going to watch my breath, and you notice your awareness. And there's about a million parts of your mind all working just to have that simple awareness. And we're not aware of those parts, you know, and we're not talking the brain again. So never mind, we just think awareness. Now, two parts of our mind we can think about, and we just have to pretend we can observe them. It's all just intellectual for us. One part is called vigilance, and this is in the beginning a really crucial part that has to play a big role. His Holiness calls it the policeman. So it's a part of your mind that's kind of like watching the awareness. And the moment awareness wanders off the breath, which of course it will within a half a second because that's its habit, vigilance kind of brings it back. Right? Thinking even just this one, just this. So there's part of you watching the breath, another part of you is watching the awareness. It sounds complicated, it sounds busy, but there's each thing your mind does, there's a certain part of your mind that plays that role. It's quite subtle. One doesn't see this at the time. We have to really know our mind well, and of course you have to know Buddhist psychology to give the names, because it's very different from the materialist view of the mind. So just get a general feeling of this. Awareness is watching the breath. You watch the breath go out. The awareness watches the breath go in. Then you wander off and you start involved in the conversation with all your thoughts, which of course is what happens. Or you get agitated because you hear a sound. Then your mind starts getting annoyed. Or this is the stuff that happens all the time in this constant, constant sound, blanket of chatter, you know. And our tendency is just to unconsciously, impulsively, just unawareedly just follow it. That's what we do. So within a second, we'd be wandering off, chatting away. Or the other extreme thing that happens in meditation is we get sleepy. The mind gets dull. So we either go off and chat crazily or the mind gets dull. So in the classic commentaries on how to concentrate, the meditation technique, they talk about the two main obstacles to getting the mind focused is either the mind gets excited or the mind gets dull. And these are the two extremes that we naturally go between. So what we're trying to do is counter those two extremes, you know. And every time you basically go back to the breath, you bring your mind back to the breath, you bring your mind back to the object, in this case, the breath. So it's this actually very disciplined technique that demands effort, that demands rigor and real clarity. It's not just sit down, close your eyes and space out. This is such a misconception. That is not called meditation. The other thing about this type of technique, it is not relaxation. That's a completely different thing. This is not relaxation. It is you're training your mind to do the exact opposite of what it does all the time, which is to focus. So it's really, it demands discipline, it demands clarity, it demands effort. Don't think it doesn't. So this is what this technique is. If you want to relax, lie down, please. It's a lot easier. And just space out. And we need to relax. We're all so tense. But this is not that. In the long term, your mind will be so blissfully relaxed, you won't believe it. But that's way to go, baby, you know. It's like when you first learn to walk on a tightrope. It's hilarious to think you just sit there being blissing out and spontaneous. Don't be ridiculous. As soon as you're on the rope, you're off again. You've got to work so hard to do what eventually looks effortless. Same here, believe me. And the reason 99% of us won't pursue this is because it takes too much effort, because we're all bone lazy, you know. It takes immense effort. So, okay, just for a few minutes, quality, 3-4 minutes, okay? You're going to determine, I will watch the breath. Have your awareness on the breath. The millisecond you wander off the breath, bring your mind back to the breath. And even if you bring your mind back to the breath 30, 40, 50, 60 times a minute, that's excellent. Don't think you did a bad meditation. Spacing out and forgetting what you're doing for a minute, that's a bad meditation. Okay, just watch our breath. As it goes out, as it goes in. Just bring the mind back to the breath, sharp and focused. Just the breath. So now relax. It's about 3 minutes, and it's good to have quality 3 minutes rather than spaced out five, you know, or 10 or 20, for God's sake. I remember doing a meditation retreat with Lama Yeshe, and we did 3, 4, 5 minute sessions. And I remember a friend of mine who was a serious meditator, you know, doing a single point of concentration meditation retreat for 18 months. He said, you know, you start with thinking, the second you wander off the breath, you've got to start the whole session again. So it's this real kind of impetus to really focus the mind, you know, even if it's 5 minutes. So don't think, oh, that was short, you know, how boring. Because most of the time we do this, it's just spacing out. It's not actually meditating at all. We've got to really be clear what we're trying to do, you know. We've got these very vague notions of what we think we're trying to do. And one of the biggest ones is we think it's about relaxing because we get frantic and desperate. Oh, must meditate, must meditate. It's It's really not the, it's not the right approach, you know. It's a highly disciplined technique that demands incredible effort to get anywhere against this massive impulse of this mind of ours just to sink into its stories, you know. Okay. So let's use that same focus on listening. Because that's the point. Even if we do a little bit of this every day, the benefit isn't just when you sit for 5 minutes and get a nice feeling. The benefit is that you're training your mind to focus. And that means on your, when you're driving or walking and you're focusing on what's going on in here as opposed to on the ugly people out there upsetting you. So it's just, you know, training for life, really. So, okay, let's continue more from yesterday. What have we talked about so far? We've looked at the whole path, basically, the whole packaging of Buddha's teachings. We use the one structure called the three principal aspects of the path, renunciation, bodhicitta, and emptiness, especially this because it's the context for understanding how to prepare our mind to do practices seriously, to enter into the practice of Tantra, as they would say, that Tara belongs to. Although, like I said yesterday, there are ways of, you know, applying these different levels of practice in a simple way, even though you can say Tantra is the most advanced. And Lama Yeshe was so marvellous in that way, explaining the psychology of Tantra and helping us get the essence of it into our daily life, which is essentially the attitude of self-respect, honouring yourself, rejoicing, delighting in your qualities, divine pride, they call it. So this is something very practical for us in our daily lives, instead of self-pity and self and misery the whole time. And anyway, so the three principles, renunciation. We've got to have renunciation. So renunciation is a way of, a name we can give to the accomplishment of the first stages of practice. If we look at the packaging called the Lam Rim, graded path, path gradual, Lam Rim. And that is this arcane term that we would translate very happily in our world as a course. So all of Buddha's teachings are presented very nicely into this course. This is coming from Atisha, the 11th century scholar, saint, master, who was invited to Tibet and spent the last years of his life there, somewhere in the 11th century. And this is the basis for sure of Tsongkhapa, our lineage lama, the 14th century, for his teachings on the commentaries on the Lam Rim. He coined the term Lam Rim. And it's just the points of the Buddha's teachings, all the metaphysics and the meditation and the skill and the bodhicitta, emptiness and karma, all the business in a nice orderly way according to the level of the capability of the practitioner, just like any information is presented in a course, according to the level of the practitioner. This is very obvious. So all the practices in the first stages under the heading of renunciation. This is is the first stages of the Lam Rim called great junior. I call it junior school and high school. It's the lowest and middle scope practices. Another analogy I like to use is the wings of the bird. So that's all the wisdom wing. It's all the teachings that's known as of Theravadan Buddhism that's practiced in the countries like Burma and Thailand. So the very first level of that is controlling your body and speech. As we talked, disciplining your body and speech. Don't harm sentient beings. Why? Because it'll harm you, baby. So it's this first point about karma, which is already so advanced, and yet it's junior school. So heavy duty for us to get this, that there are consequences to me of everything I think and do and say. Brand new idea. We get this when it comes to food, like I said, you know. We get it when it comes to the body. We do not get it when it comes to the mind. Or morality, because we think morality is imposed by someone out there, and who are they to tell me what to do, we'll think. But this dualistic view, you know, whereas the Buddha says morality is a natural law. People don't like being harmed. I harm them because I'm, you know, so we harm ourselves. It's a natural law. We've got to think about that. When we get this, we can have an enormous sense of self-respect and not want to lie or kill or steal, because who would want to harm themselves? But this takes time to see this. This is all the basis of the renunciation. Renouncing what? Suffering and its causes. So this particularly, you know, we can understand if we look at the Four Noble Truths, another package of Buddha's teachings. This is the Lord Buddha himself taught this the first time after he got enlightened, and he taught to his some disciples in Deer Park near Varanasi in India. That there is suffering. Remember, we discussed the three kinds briefly. And the second one is there are causes of suffering. Got to know that. Karma and delusions. The third is there is a state that you can be free of it. And the fourth is how to do it. So renunciation, if we're renouncing suffering and its causes, you have to know what suffering is and you have to know what its causes are. And suffering is, we described, the regular kind of suffering, in-your-face suffering, suffering of suffering. Second one, more tricky, so much more tricky, so hard to see, so hard to see, so hard to see. The inner prison, as Rinpoche said, the prison of attachment, the prison of anger, prison of pride, prison of depression. Or the suffering of change, Buddha calls it. That what we call happiness turns into what we call suffering, and you can't have one without the other. It's another simple way of putting it. You know, the eating of the chocolate cake, which we are so convinced is the cause of happiness, leads inexorably to the suffering of being too full. The most delicious happiness in this universe, the best sex in the universe, if you keep doing it, it'll become disgusting. This is the point the Buddha's making. The best thing in the universe that we think is the best happiness doesn't last. It turns into suffering. And to understand this takes, this is the thing of studying Buddha's teachings, understanding the delusions, understanding how things exist, understanding impermanence. It's quite a subtle point to really understand it. This is why we have to hear the teachings if we're trying to seriously be a Buddhist, not just say the words, you know. You can say, oh, yes, E equals MC squared. Oh, I know that. What's it mean? Oh, I don't know. And that's our trouble. We say, oh, yeah, karma. What's it mean? Oh, I don't know, cause and effect. That's useless, you know. Impermanence, oh, things change. It's just not enough. We've got to put more meat on the bones. And then the worst, the subtler suffering, which is too abstract for our minds, is all-pervasive suffering, as they call it. Excuse me. So the causes of suffering... We look in the second noble truth. Two things. Buddha narrows it down to two things, just two. There are millions of things that come together to produce any one thing. If you started looking at the causes of a cup, you're going to have a book, fat book. You've got to have a look at the causes of a door, the causes of a building, the causes of a thermos, the causes of a book. You have to write in like a, instruction manual. It'd be massive. Well, the causes of a moment of happiness or the causes of a moment of suffering, which is what we're discussing here. As far as we're concerned, there's one cause and it's called you. If I, as far as I'm concerned, if I'm happy, it's, Fred made me happy. He was kind to me. So it's sort of like I blame you for making me happy. I believe you're the cause of my happiness. What does that bring? Enormous attachment. And manipulating to get you to do it again. This is samsara, Look at us. We think that. We don't think we play a role. We think it's all Fred. You make me happy, so you better keep making me happy. This is what brings attachment. It's so obvious. Then you've got suffering, which is what we're discussing here. Suffering. As far as I'm concerned, there's one cause of my suffering. Fred was mean to me. That's it. And look at the world. Look at the behavior of the world. We can deduce that that's the philosophy of the world. That a person out there, an institution out there, an event out there is the main cause of my suffering. That's why we blame, sue, kill, divorce. Look at the world. It's very obvious what our philosophy is and we don't question it. And this is what Buddha's getting us to do. And it really sounds so simple, but it's unbelievably hard to do because it's his view of the main causes of suffering is the opposite of what we think. So to look into his view, take it as your hypothesis, and then slowly try to prove it to yourself from your own experience is immensely difficult. Immensely difficult. That's why just merely believing it is utterly, it's worse than useless. It's superstition. It won't help. So we have to analyze it, look into it, and slowly, slowly, the penny begins to drop. Slowly, slowly, we can begin to see the truth of what Buddha is saying. But it just takes time. And what he says, there are two main causes of suffering, hundreds of causes, but the two essential ones, such that when you identify those, then you've got the method to solve the problem. And we all know, if you can't accurately identify the cause of a problem, you know, you can never, ever, ever solve the problem. So finding the causes of the problem is pretty important. Be precise. We need to be precise. So the two main causes of any moment of suffering for the Buddha, two, and they're both in me. Big surprise. Fred is a cause, but he's only a secondary cause. He's only a catalyst for my suffering. And that's a shock to us. So we have to really think about it. He says two main causes, both inside me. I'm the boss here, you know. One is karma, as they call it, karma and delusion. Just the two words, karma, delusion. And they subsume down to the one, delusion. So karma, like we've said, is a very broadly used word, and we use it in a very colloquial way. We really don't get it to be very accurate, you know. So to be really accurate, you can say, like I've been saying, the word actually can be translated as the word intention. So right there, it points to the mind, doesn't it? So what Buddha's meaning generally by the law of karma is that the, you know, we hear it, oh yes, it's the law of cause and effect. Oh yes, it means action, this kind of thing. But the real essential meaning of this law of karma is that what Buddha's saying is that everything that goes on in a person's mind, the ant's mind, the dog's mind, the spirit's mind, whatever the sentient being is, whatever's going on moment by moment in that mind, that is the main cause of future experiences of that being. That's all he's saying. That is the main cause of the future experiences of that sentient being. So in other words, another way to put it is whatever I'm experiencing now is the fruit of the seeds I planted in my mind in the past. So whatever went on my mind in the past is naturally ripening the present as my experiences. It is not a complicated concept, but it's so absolutely different from the view we have now. It really takes time to hear it, you know, to unpack the idea. So what Buddha's saying, like we said, every microsecond of what our mind is doing is, if you like, programming our mind, sowing seeds in the mind, leaving impressions in the mind, whatever words you like, that don't just go astray, but are indeed programming your consciousness, this river of mental moments, continuously. And that programming will necessarily ripen in just the way that you did it. So whatever you think and do, and thinking is the first one, thoughts first, and then on the basis of thoughts, we know, we then say words and do actions. We know that. So the actions, so they say that karma is referring to the action of the mind. Another word for karma is action, the mental action, the thought, the intention, which then, as we know, many of those thoughts manifest as physical and verbal actions. We can see this, but it comes from the thoughts. It's surprising to us because we don't think so half the time. Because why? Because so many of our verbal and physical actions are so spontaneous that they don't seem to have anything to do with what's happening in my mind. And that's because we've practiced those things to perfection, you know. If you have a tendency to be angry, you don't think you're thinking angry thoughts and then you say angry words. That sounds almost hilarious. Before you know it, the words are vomiting out your mouth. Just because it's all in your mind. But it's so programmed, so instant, quicker than Google. Out it comes out the mouth before you realize. Because of the training, because we've practiced it. And the Buddha says we come fully programmed with all these tendencies, you know. So knowing this can be quite humbling, because then we go, okay, then I better start looking at this programming, unpacking all the programming, changing these habits, because they're just habits. They're not set in stone. Feel like it, but they're not. And that's the great, that's the liberating idea. They're just a bunch of habits. And we know you can change habits, but they're very deep habits. From the first second of conception, you're programmed, you know, from all your past, millions of your past habits come and manifest as this particular person. Which is why, for the Buddha, we absolutely have to know our mind. That's why we have to do concentration meditation. That's why we have to go deep into the mind and unravel and unpack all this stuff in there, you know. Because this is the main cause of who I am, of all my experiences and my future lives, because they're all my experiences. We create our own realities. We don't think we create them. Not like magic wand creating, how we think of creation, you know, like a miracle just happens. It's an evolutionary process, you know. And we are the one who created. This is the big shock. This is the big shock. And it's very empowering when we can take it on board. Instead of the other one, which is the victim. Ego is the victim. I didn't ask to get born. It's not my fault. This is the deepest instinct of ego. Primordial. Everybody else's fault. I didn't ask to get born. He did it. She did it. Mummy did it. Daddy did it. We love to blame. And if you're Italian, you blame God. I've heard the Greeks do as well. But I can't. No, most other countries I've been to, no one blames God. Only the Italians. They have the rudest, worst words for God when things go wrong. Apparently in Italy, Lama Yeshe visited one of his old Geshe friends, who was the resident teacher at our Italian center near Pisa in the 80s, the early 80s. And they were in the ward, you know, and all the Italian men were there, and the Italian boys there were translating for Lama the rude things that they were saying about God when things go wrong, like God is a pig, you know, for example. I mean, I was a Catholic. You never said one bad word about God, you know. It'd come through the ceiling, and you just never did. But I've heard Greeks as well. Are there any Greeks here? Any Italians here? Okay, there you go. Okay, so karma, pretty big deal. Often people hear about Buddhism and they think, you know, oh, karma, yeah, I don't know. Nah, karma's silly, you know. The fact is, when you look at all Buddha's teachings, his philosophy, his whole big view, karma's absolutely central. You can't avoid karma. People like to say, oh, yeah, Buddha doesn't have a creator. Well, you can't just say that and not look at the implication of that. And that's where, when you look at the implication of no creator, then you have to look at karma, because that's the explanation. So karma and delusions. A delusion is we look into the mental consciousness. This is where we look into the mind, and actually this is the high school. High school. This is the middle scope teachings, where you start looking at the root of the problem. So you could say that karma, which is the actions we do, coming from the mind, but the actions of body and speech. You know, like I said yesterday, we are very social beings. We all interact. We get born to another person. We just don't manifest, you know, spontaneously on this earth, do we? We need a mummy. So we've clearly got intense history with very many other sentient beings. We live in groups. We have enemies. We have friends. There are strangers. We have wars. We love. We hate. Everything is social and necessarily related to other sentient beings. So this is, we create karma with each other. Therefore, obviously, we experience karma with each other. And the ones we get beaten up by, the ones we get bombed by, the ones we get loved by, are the ones we have done that to. So it's not too cosmic an idea, you know. Whereas we think it's random. You get these ugly parents, or you get these beautiful parents. It's just sort of potluck. I find that view so scary, frankly. The karma one seems to me much more appealing, you know. So we need to get, karma is all that process of what the mind does and the body and speech and interacting and then all the, so then the karma ripens, as we said yesterday, in four ways. I'll go to delusions in a minute. Karma ripens in four ways. There's different ways of talking, but this for me is the most tastiest. If we look into our life now, we can divide into four the ways our past actions have now present ripened in the present. The first is the type of life we have. The very first, and this is the biggest surprise to us, to think that our actions created me as a human, as opposed to mummy and daddy. Big shock, or as opposed to God, you know? Big surprise. I'm the boss. So the first way our karma ripens, you know, from the past, is in this fact that we have in this human life, in our case, human. And this is already very fascinating, you know. Let's talk about this, how we, the death process, because, not too much, but a bit. The book I'm working on of Lama Zopa Rinpoche's right now is How to Help People at the Time of Death. And as part of it is understanding the process of death, because death is the most precious time to help anybody. You want to help somebody in their life, death is the best. Because their life's over now, and death is the time when the new life will be determined. And this is a really vital time. So death is the most precious time. The greatest yogis, as Lama Zopa said, they're the ones who are advanced, who are really ready for it themselves. That's the time they've been waiting for, because now they can get to the subtle level and really do the meditation and really rid the mind of all the rubbish when the mind gets subtle. But for most of us, it's, you know, at the time of death, at the least, needs to be, we need to have a happy mind. And we need to have a virtuous mind, two things. So Buddha's view, psychologically speaking, virtuous mind and happy mind, they come together. Non-virtuous mind and unhappy mind, they come together. And you can look at this pretty quickly in your own experience. Negative states of mind, like we talked, I'm going now to the high school and looking at the model of the mind, which is also getting us to understand delusions, okay? The second cause of suffering. We're looking at the different packages here. So we've got sensory consciousness, Buddha says, and we have mental consciousness. And already this is very fascinating. The way the senses function is very limited. We make the body the boss, Lama Yeshe says. But it's a real mistake. We're so addicted, because we are sensory beings, we are living in this world of attachment, this desire realm, as Buddha says, living in our mind, living in this body with the five holes, the demand feeding, the senses. And this runs our lives. It's the level at which we function. Our materialist world only posits the physical, you know. So, you know, we'll say, oh, what a lovely cup. I'll go, what a nice cup, you know. And you actually think your eyes are seeing a nice cup. Well, it's just not true. Your eyes are merely seeing shape and colour. That's it. But then in a millisecond, and it really is true, quicker than Google, this triggers the eye consciousness, the awareness through my eye consciousness of shape and colour in a millisecond triggers my mental consciousness, which is where the computer is, if you like, which is where the workshop is, as Lama Zopa says, which is where all the imprints are, all the memories, all stored, truly quicker than Google. Google's a great example, you know. It's so brilliantly programmed. Within 0.28 seconds this morning, my entry of something, and it got 11 million results in 0.28 seconds. Your mind is even quicker. The mental consciousness is even quicker. It's very fascinating when you study Buddhist psychology in more depth, how it works. Not talking the brain. Keep remembering. We're talking the thoughts. So that eye consciousness, the awareness through your eye consciousness of shape and colour, in a millitrillionth of a second triggers your mental consciousness and brings up all the, you know, all the millions of labels. And in the next millisecond, there's no saying, you look at it and you go, oh, what's that? And you have to look up Google for a round thing with, you know, oh, that's called a cup. No, we know it instantaneously. So your mental consciousness brings up the label cup, brings up the label blue, brings up the label the shape, brings up all the things. And because of my taste in my car, let's say I like blue. My mummy used to dress me in blue when I was a little girl. I was always the blue one. So whatever, I like blue. I find when I see blue, my mind is pleased, okay? So within a millisecond, I say, there is a nice cup. It suits my style, that shape and colour fit, you know. So all this is happening in the mental consciousness. It's not a function of your eyes. It's a joke, actually. It's your mental consciousness. This already tells us so much. If I see Fred and say, isn't he divine? I think my eyes are seeing a handsome person. No, it's my mental consciousness making up this elaborate story about that shape and colour. And this is really, again, pointing us to what Buddha's saying, that everything really is made by our mind. So, mental consciousness. We're looking at... I'm suddenly going to many things here. I'm trying to look at the process of how we die, the necessity, you know, the... and then looking at the mind of delusion. All these things, so we'll get them, we'll cover them. Okay, so mental consciousness, this is where the workshop is, and this is where we have to learn to know, unpack, unravel, because this is where the causes of happiness and suffering are. So, okay, as I mentioned before, the time of death, need a happy mind more than anything, and a virtuous mind, and how these go together naturally. So in the mental consciousness, we divide it. Buddhist psychology divides. This is also helping us understand delusions, which is the second cause of suffering, the main one in the second noble truth. In order to get renunciation, in order to practice tantra. That's where we're going, okay? As we talked yesterday. So delusions. In the mental consciousness, we can divide the categories of all of our thoughts, and there are trillions of them, into three simple categories. There's no fourth. Positive states of mind, negative states of mind, neutral states of mind. Positive, negative have a particular taste, particular characteristics, very specific, and this again is unique to Buddhist psychology. The third category, when we say neutral or neither, doesn't mean they're not important. The majority, probably, of all the states of mind, I like to call them the mechanics of the mind or the plumbing of the mind. All the characteristics in the mind, like I said, concentration, or the term called mindfulness, which refers to capacity to remember what you're doing from moment to moment, they aren't in their nature virtuous or non-virtuous. But they, you know, but we need them to do. Like a person who kills needs really good mindfulness. If they kind of lose the plot and forget what they're doing, they're going to kill the wrong person. They need good discrimination. They're going to know there's Fred and there's Mary, and they want to kill Fred, not Mary. So all these are characteristics in the mind that play an enormous role in doing anything properly. And of course, they're taught in the context of meditating and getting realizations, you know. So the positive and negative have this really powerful role in our lives, because the positive ones, the Buddha says, are the source of my happiness. And then by extension, the source of my ability to make others happy, to help others. And incidentally, Buddha's saying, they are at the core of my being. So that when you're a Buddha, you're full of those. There's nothing else there. The negative ones, and this is why it's so important for Buddhist practice, to know Buddhist psychology. They are the source of my suffering. They are the source of all suffering. So we look at the second noble truth, two causes of suffering, karma and delusions. The two subsumed down to the one, delusions, or negative state of mind. Finally, when it comes down to it, they are the source of all suffering, period. Easy to say, but we have to learn it if we're trying to take Buddhism on board in our lives. So the negative states of mind have two main characteristics, which necessarily you could say the positive ones lack. The negative ones, or the delusions, these words are used generally, synonymous. The neuroses, the neurotic states of mind, the afflictive emotions, as you read a lot in the Buddhist literature, the disturbing emotions, as you'd see, another synonym, all referring to the same thing. These delusions, these disturbing emotions, have two main characteristics. And they're indicated by these different terms. One is they're deeply disturbing. And it's so evident to us, it is evident to us, we know it's disturbing to be angry or jealous, depressed. We know it's very, very painful. We know this already. But we think it's normal. We think it's natural. You're born like this. And then you think it's not your fault. And then you think it's his fault and her fault and their fault. So we end up making it like a nightmare, because we dig these delusions deeper and deeper into the mind by blaming everybody else, by thinking it's not my fault, but thinking it's natural. So we never do anything about them until it's too late, you know. And all Buddha's saying is these states of mind are deeply disturbing, and because we're taking on board the idea that they are the main cause of my suffering, we need to get to know them. And that's why you have to concentrate and get meditation, so you know your thoughts. Not just know, oh, I'm angry, yeah, okay. But then you're looking at it like you're looking at pollution in the water. With a scientific approach, you know your water can be free of pollution. You know that, there's a possibility. Third noble truth, water can be free of pollution. So you'd better learn to identify the pollution, hadn't you? Don't try to avoid it. Don't just curse it and swear about it. Don't blame everybody else for putting it there. Don't keep, you know, suing BP for it. It is their fault, maybe. But you've got to learn to know the nature of that pollution, don't you? Why? Because now you know what it is. You can identify it, and you know you can remove it. This is the context. This is why you want to know your mind. This is why you want to get involved and look at your delusions. Not to make yourself feel miserable, not to get depressed, not to feel guilty. You should be rejoicing every time you see your disgusting mind. Every time you see your anger, your depression, your jealousy, your low self-esteem, all the rubbish in the mind, so tricky, these voices of ego. You've got to look with a scientific, delighted mind. Hey, there it is. And then you can see how it causes you suffering, and then you're proving Buddha's point, and now you know I can get rid of it. So it's a whole different way of looking, not guilt. Not shame, not depressed, not I'm hopeless. The logical reason why you want to identify the delusions. And the fundamental point, remember, that's the basis of Buddha's teachings is that they're adventitious, meaning they do not belong. They are not at the core of my being. They are not integral to who I am, so therefore they can be removed. This is the point. So when, with that view, you're so happy to identify the pollution. You're so happy to wade in deep into the stinking rotten oil because you know you've got to identify it in order to get rid of it. So there's real logic to it. But you've got to have a courageous mind to do this. You know, we don't like seeing the horrible stuff in there. It's too painful. And then we've got to have patience because it won't go overnight. Okay, so delusions. Or they're disturbing emotions. They are deeply disturbing themselves. And this is already an amazing point. When you see a person screaming and crying, you know, and then you discover the mother hit the little boy and he's screaming and crying. The first thing we do is, well, first thing we see a person suffering and then we have to find who did it to them. And then all our energy goes onto the mother. How dare she do this? Who does she think she is? And we blame her and curse her. And we see the child screaming and crying. We see that he's suffering. We see that he's out of his brain, having a mental breakdown. We see he's screaming and suffering, maybe just angry because mummy told him off or whatever. So what we do is we look at the cause, which we think is mummy. But the Buddhist approach, mummy maybe was a good mummy and she told him off. Let's say mummy is a good mummy. And she told him off, but he's screaming and crying. So we tend to assume, if we see a person screaming and crying, we tend to assume the person who caused it must be really naughty. The more the screaming and crying, the more naughty the person. But maybe not true. The Buddhist approach is mummy might have been nice or might not have been nice. That's one thing. Get her out of the way. Deal with that. But now we've got to deal with the person screaming and crying. And that's what Buddha's saying about our mind. We have to look at that itself. Look at that itself. Look at that itself. Don't just do this, mother must be very evil, which is what we do ourselves. So if I'm really jealous, and Tekchok's my boyfriend, and I'm really strongly jealous, even he just looks at someone else, I'll be freaking out, won't I? So, you know, we tend to assume the more my freak out, the more naughty he is. This is logic for the deluded mind. This is completely logical for the deluded mind. I blame him. He maybe did nothing. But I've got a tendency to be jealous. So when I go to my therapist, they're going to find out what mummy did to me and what daddy did to me and what my genes and my chemicals and my DNA, trying to find the source of why I got this strong response. Because we have to assume someone must have done something terrible to me. I'm being sort of naive about it now, a bit simplistic. But the Buddha's approach, it's helpful to do that. It's good to check on the outside. But finally, you have to look into the mind itself. Finally, I have to look into my jealousy itself. My jealousy, and this is the Buddha's point, the jealousy itself is the problem. And the reason, the main reason for the jealousy is the tendency to be jealous. And where does my tendency for jealousy to come from? My previous jealousy. And where does that come from? The previous tendency. And where does that come from? The previous jealousy. And where does that come from? The previous jealousy. And where does that come from? The previous jealousy. And where does that come from? The previous jealousy. And I get back to the first second of conception in my mummy's womb. And where does that come from? The previous jealousy. You keep tracking it back in this very rigorous way. That is the main cause of my jealousy. My jealousy. My tendency. Tekchok is just the catalyst. Mummy, what she did to me when I was a child is the catalyst. But my jealousy is the result of my jealousy. This seems so outrageous to us, but it's almost embarrassingly simple, you know. But we're so dualistic and so used to the view, I'm jealous because she did this. I'm happy because he did that. This dualistic view, this is the view of our the physical world, the materialist world. It's quite intense point. Why are you happy, Robina? Oh, Tech Talk was nice to me. No, I'm happy because I have a tendency to be happy. He's merely the trigger. And that happiness comes from my previous tendency to be happy. And that comes from my previous happiness. And that comes like that. You track it back in the mind itself. It isn't complicated. It's just that it's so absolutely different from the way we tend to think now. So this is being your own therapist in Buddhism is very tasty. You don't look into the past, into the physical, into the, what the person did. You can, it's helpful, but it's not, it won't give you the solution. It's sort of like looking into BP and looking at what they did and how dare they do this and they did that and they did this. The thing you've got to do finally is look at the nature of the pollution itself. Then you can see its actual components. Then you can break it down and get rid of it. That's the practice of being a Buddhist. And it's extremely hard work because everything in us doesn't want to do that. We want to do the other one. So it's pretty intense, you know. As long as Oprah says, in this world, we don't even know our mind plays a role at all. I know I'm jealous, but hey, he did it. It's not my fault. It's my genes, my DNA. Mummy did it, Daddy did it. We're frantically saying this. We don't even recognize that it's mine, that it's my mind, you know. So delusions. So the disturbing part is the first one, disturbingness, deeply disturbing, so painful, unbearable, like a nightmare. But the other one, and this is the word delusion, they're liars, they're misconceptions, you know. And this is the point of Buddhist psychology, that if we begin to get this, so much of Buddhist practice falls into place. So much of Buddhist view falls into place. I tell you. Understanding how these unhappy emotions come down to being misconceptions at the subtlest level. They're highly developed, elaborate conceptual stories that we are programmed completely to perfection to have. The instantaneous response. They're just so totally programmed. And that because they're so programmed and so instinctive, then, you know, they manifest instantly as a feeling and emotion through the body. That's the proof that we've practiced anger to perfection, you know. To think that anger is a bunch of misconceptions sounds like a cruel joke, you know. Or attachment is a bunch of misconceptions. And this is really the essence of what Buddha's saying, and this is actually leading us also to understand the whole view about emptiness. Everything comes down to being a view. This is really the toughest thing to see, you know. So anyway, we're talking renunciation first. The first stage is to practice. Control your body and speech. Why? Because doing negative things to others harms you. Why? Because your motivation is your delusion. Anger, attachment, ignorance. The three main ones. So control your body and speech. Back off. Leave sentient beings alone. So then you train your mind to have more discipline. You're stopping sowing that many negative seeds. You're giving your mind space, and now you can get to second scope, high school, and start looking at the mind itself, looking at these delusions, seeing how they are the cause of your suffering, and how they're disturbing, and how they're liars. And slowly through contemplating the mind, you begin to unpack them, unravel them, deconstruct them, and argue with them, and slowly replace them. Like write new stories, you know, the virtuous stories. From this, recognizing that you're suffering, three kinds, knowing the causes, being karma and delusions, being exhausted by this suffering and knowing the causes, that is what brings renunciation, which is I must get the hell out of this mess, I must change my mind. This is already incredible. This is already, you're an amazing practitioner. And this is junior school and high school, the first and second scopes of the Lam Rim, the first wisdom wing, where you really become this amazing person, self-respectful, mature, adult, responsible, grown up, accountable, calmer, more wise, more kind, more content. Already incredible person, already amazing. This is just renunciation. first prerequisite to enter into practices like Tara. Then you can go into the compassion wing, the bodhisattva path, and you're going to cultivate bodhicitta. Bodhicitta. Amazing state of mind. You know, amazing, amazing state of mind. Like all these terms, it's got a very clear definition. It's very specific. And this is something we find a bit surprising when it comes to spiritual. We know we need to be specific and precise when it comes to maths and cooking and gardening and everything else, but not when it comes to emotional stuff. We're all very vague about it. Well, Buddha's, the same precision that we know you need to use for maths and cooking is what Buddha uses to understand the mind. Karma, the view of the universe, his view. So bodhicitta, bodhicitta, awakening thought is the translation, I think, of the Sanskrit. Awakening, bodhi, is coming from the word Buddha. One of the terms they use for Buddha is a fully awake person, the implication being we're fast asleep because of delusions. Remember the word, again, I said in Tibetan for Buddha, sangye. I think it's the Tibetan. The first, that is Tibetan, but I think the I've heard, I don't speak it, the first word, the first syllable, sung, like Bud, implies the complete eradication from your mind of all the neuroses, all the delusions, all the misconceptions, all the disturbing emotions, which Buddha says that they're not, are adventitious and can be removed and which are the cause of all suffering. So sung implies eradication of all of this. And then the second syllable, ge, Buddha, implies the complete development of all the goodness, simply speaking. And this is the simple point that Buddha's making back in high school: delusions, the mind, the mental consciousness, three characteristics, negative ones, positive ones, and all the others. When you finally develop the Buddha one, fully developed, all the delusions gone, all the virtues fully developed. Simple way of putting it. This is Buddha's view, in his view of the mind. So bodhicitta is referring to, you can call it an aspiration, or this strong impulse in the mind of a person who has accomplished it, to two parts: constantly only ever want to help others, spontaneously. One of the first signs of the accomplishment of bodhicitta is that there's no longer the thought of I, the normal neurotic way. And you no longer even think of anything for yourself. You no longer ask for anything for yourself. We find this inconceivable, and we think you're mentally ill if you were like this. You know, so this is sort of like the peak of university level, accomplishing bodhicitta. So it has aspect, bodhicitta, the aspect. One part is this constant, unceasing wish to never stop benefiting others, helping others, freeing them from suffering. And this, and where this comes from is the wisdom of having developed enormous compassion and enormous love based upon developing the first stages of practice, you know, controlling your body, speech, and mind. And we'll talk about these qualities. And the other part of bodhicitta is the long-term one of, because you're on the path to Buddhahood. You're on your road to Buddhahood, aren't you? You're in the course, and you graduate as a Buddha. So then the other aspect of bodhicitta is to unceasingly never stop perfecting your mind, getting rid of all the delusions, till eventually you accomplish Buddhahood. Why? Because then you are qualified perfectly to benefit sentient beings perfectly for as long as time exists. This is what they say. So bodhicitta, pretty intense. And then emptiness, the third prerequisite. Having the, you know, it's like the culmination of the Buddha's teachings of the view. They refer to it in the literature as the view. But actually all of Buddha's understanding of the mind is about view. And it's all the earlier stages of developing understanding of delusions and the neuroses and how they all work, which is like in the middle scope, like high school, which brings your renunciation. This is the basis of getting to the view of emptiness. If you are practicing the Theravadin path, which is the Hinayana school of thought, which is junior school and high school, which is the wisdom wing, which is the first and second scopes, if you are just practicing this and you are going to graduate there, then you would then not just have renunciation, but then you'd continue to meditate, and you'd meditate on emptiness and eventually remove the delusions from your mind. And then when you die, you'd disappear into bliss. You've achieved your own nirvana. You'd achieve your own liberation. So emptiness itself is a Theravadin teaching, is a Hinayana teaching, but it's taught in the context of the Lam Rim, in the context of the compassion wing, in connection with bodhicitta. Emptiness is taught in connection with bodhicitta. That's why you'll often see in the literature, you'll refer to ultimate bodhicitta and relative bodhicitta. Ultimate bodhicitta is emptiness taught in the context of the Mahayana and related to bodhicitta. And then there's relative bodhicitta, which is bodhicitta itself. So emptiness, how things exist ultimately. And the conventional way of putting that is dependent arising, which is getting us to the last point last night, dependent arising. Dependent arising, as Lama Yeshe puts it, paraphrasing Tsongkhapa, is the king of logics to prove emptiness. And this is all about the view, how things exist. The bottom line for the Buddha is learning to be in sync with how things exist. Why? Because right now the pollution in our minds, the delusions, are preventing us from seeing how things exist, are causing us to see things in a way they don't exist. And this is the reason we suffer. This is quite abstract. This is back to the meaning of the word delusion. It's abstract for us. We know they're suffering. We know they're painful. We know that that life can be very disturbing when you're jealous and angry and all the dramas that come from it. But to hear that they're delusional, to hear that we're delusional, to hear that we're not in sync with reality when we're jealous and angry seems kind of confusing to us. But this is the Buddha's approach. This is his amazing view of the mind and how it functions. So by understanding high school, the second scope, and how the mind works, this leads us beautifully to understand emptiness, dependent arising, the two truths. So we can talk about that. That's a summary of how we talked yesterday, I think. So are we, any questions? So we can continue on. Yes, sweetheart. Where's the mic, please?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Rabina, do you think there's any place for working as a therapist?
Oh, darling, I think it's the best job to do. The best job to do, if you're Buddhist, the best job to do is to help people's minds. How amazing. It's perfect. I mean, if you're really skillful, the more you can know, you know, if you want to be a Buddhist, let's say, the more you internalize all this, the more that does inform your ability to help other people's minds, even in a limited way, even just helping them love their hubby better. It doesn't matter. You have to help people according to their level. Okay. That's it. If you want to be a Buddhist therapist, using the word colloquially, then you go off and you teach Buddhism for those who want it. But if you're going to be a therapist in the ordinary world, that means help their minds. So you can be a fully qualified Buddhist, have the view of karma, have the view of bodhicitta, have the view of renunciation, but you can just, according to that person's needs, you help them. You mightn't say one Buddhist word, but all the things you do will be informed by your Buddhism, and you'll be a very, 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 very good therapist.
Okay, that's a huge relief.
God, yes. Absolutely, there's no question, you know.
I have to earn a living.
That's right, darling. No, but you can see my point.
Yeah, I do.
You know, did we get all fundamentalist about it? Like a person who becomes a fundamentalist Buddhist, they're going to have to say, well, I've got to tell you about karma. That's nonsense. It's naive to think this way. We have to help people according to their needs. And that's including even, you know, you'd have to. You just have to. That's our job. That's what wisdom is helping a person according to their needs. So if you have a patient who comes who is a Buddhist, then you can talk Buddhism. Of course you can. Yeah. But a person who comes who's a fundamentalist Christian, you help them according to their needs.
Okay.
Help them love God more. That's okay. Right. No contradiction, you know.
Right. Okay.
Please.
That's a huge relief.
Good.
To me.
I'm happy. Go for it, girl. It's the best job for a Buddhist.
Can I have another one? Can I have another question? You said that with bodhicitta, that you lose all thought of, or you
the neurotic
go
eye.
Beyond all thought of I.
The neurotic eye. the unhappy, neurotic, desperate, central player in my universe, I this, and he said this to me, and I am not this, and you are, because the nature of I now is a deluded view, is unhappy, is jealous and angry. Anger, jealousy, depression, low self-esteem, pride, arrogance are all the voices of the neurotic I. So as soon as you have love and kindness and generosity, you can almost say the neurotic I is calm and he's not talking so much.
Okay,
you see, see what I'm saying? There's no sense of an I in a reasonable way. That's obviously ridiculous. There's no way. The body and knows exactly who they are, but no longer the neurotic I, the unhappy little poor self-pity me I, which is the one we think is the real I.
Okay, because Lama Zopa says, may I bring all beings to enlightenment, by myself
that's
alone.
That's the relative I, and that's what we're going to get to when we talk about dependent arising and emptiness, to get these two clear.
That's fine.
Absolutely, okay.
All right.
Good,
thanks.
Okay. Yeah. Yep. Yes, sweetheart. Yeah. What's your name? Say your name when you talk. What's your name?
Helen,
okay. May I know your name?
Yes, I'm Kitty.
Kitty, hello, darling. Talk to me.
I wanted to bring up something you said yesterday, which was about the essence of beings that continues and the trillions and trillions of essences. In what way are they empty of inherent existence?
Okay, we'll talk about this. We'll get to it when we talk about dependent arising. Thank you, Kitty. I will go into it. I will. So both your point, Helen's point, and Kitty's point will get covered. We'll go into it.
Thank you. And my question would be related to yesterday. It was, for me, it's very interesting to see that consciousness has history.
Yeah.
So it's been beginless time, we have imprints.
Sorry?
Beginless time,
yeah.
We will have imprints on this consciousness.
Every second, your mind is doing something, wouldn't you agree?
Yes.
So then that's what it's been doing since beginningless time, thinking and doing something.
But
therefore leaving an impression in the mind, programming your mind. Everything you do programs your mind, doesn't it?
Because why I'm a little confused that if beginningless time I have these imprints, is it still with me
using
today?
Using the word, forget the beginningless time. So what? Okay, say your question again, Arika. I'm a bit confused.
question would be that the consciousness in beginningless, the consciousness,
okay,
the mind is beginningless.
We're getting our head around the idea that our consciousness doesn't have a first moment. Is that the first point you're saying? Is that the question, or is it given that the mind doesn't have a first moment, then... What? Point being?
I would say that the mind has no beginning time. It's beginningless.
Okay, nothing that exists can have a first moment. As His Holiness the Dalai Lama says, Big Bang, yeah, no problem. Not the first Big Bang. You see, the problem right there in this point, and every single one of us is this, we have this deep impulse, every one of us, don't we, to think there must be a first moment. Where did it begin? Everybody I know has that question. We have it inside us, and there's an assumption that somehow things have to have a beginning. You accept this point? Feeling it feels like so absurd. It's absurd to say the opposite, right? You agree? But so we have to think it through. And so how we deal with this, if we're Christians, Muslims, that's just a philosophical view. Muslim, the creative religion, if you take away the Muslim Christian, it's just a philosophical view in the mind that manifests as the concept of a creator who is the who is the source of everything, who itself, usually he, doesn't have a source, is in a sense beginningless, but that is acceptable. When you're a naughty kid at school and you ask who created God, you're considered very rude, because God is out of those laws. This idea is that there's a being who is beyond the law of cause and effect, who is just existing, has always existed. You see, but the Buddha would say that's a misconception. That view is a misconception, because he says there can't be a thing that just exists, that isn't a product of causes and conditions, that isn't a product of dependent arising. You know, it's an impossibility. So that's one point. The other point is this. What Buddha says is that everything that does exist, if you just point to something, point to this cup, okay? We see the cup exists now. Well, Mummy, where did it begin, right? Well, darling, let's analyse it. Well, if you kept tracking it back moment by moment, this came from this, which came from the clay, which came from that, you will keep going until the first second of this universe, won't you? Yes. Won't you? Logically. So then you have to say, where did that come from? Well, guess what? A previous moment of that very energy. So in the tantric teachings, as I mentioned briefly yesterday, the model is, which is very similar to the model Galileo and our mob used back in the Middle Ages, the physical world is made of the four elements. Well, in the Buddhist teachings, there are these marvelous descriptions, especially in Tantra, of the physical universe, which is made up of the four elements. And so right back to the first second of this universe, you can say that the four elements subsumed down to the subtle wind energy. And that was just the result of previous build-up of four elements, which came from previous four elements. So you can't find a first moment of the four elements. We desperately want there to be a first moment. We just want it to be. It makes us comfy. Buddha says, what a silly idea. Now, that's the first set, and they're the same with the mind. If, as His Holiness said one time in Dharamsala, oh, it's easy to prove reincarnation. Of course, he meant theoretically, and we have to have a theoretical basis before we have experience, right? So he said, you first have to establish that there is a thing called mind. We have to establish this as our hypothesis, that mind is not physical, okay? So then we take this view. So obviously, the substantial cause of this moment of my mind, whether it's the anger part or the jealousy, doesn't matter, has to be a previous moment of that same stuff. Like, this has to be, the previous moment of this has to be clay. And then this comes from this, which comes from that, which comes from this. You track it back in a logical moment-by-moment thing. So my mind, the previous moment of this particular moment of non-physical energy known as Rabina's mind, not Erica's mind, in this body, has to be a previous moment of that non-physical energy. And you keep tracking that, and you're not going to find a first moment. You get back to the first second of conception, the egg and sperm go to mummy and daddy's bodies and go back that direction, but mind goes to its own previous moment of that particular continuity of non-physical moments. So now you keep tracking that back. So let's say I get back to the first moment of conception. Well, maybe my mind began then. Well, no, if my mind existed at the moment of conception, where you have to say that it came from a previous moment, wouldn't you? Now, let's say you keep doing that and you do it for a trillion years before this universe. Even you get back to the first moment of the universe. Well, no, forget this universe because my mind might not have been in that universe. But you track back my mind to 40 lives, 50 lives, 60, and we keep thinking, well, maybe I'll find the first moment. Then you get back to that moment. Well, where did that moment come from? Where did that moment come from?
It's earlier state.
Where did that moment come from? Just answer it.
Once
a previous moment.
Previous.
So then you track it back another million years. Where did that moment come from?
The previous.
And then track it back a trillion years.
Yes.
Where did that moment come from?
Previous. I can understand.
No, you don't. Because if you say, you know it's beginningless.
Yeah, I got that. That is beginningless.
So you're not asking if it's about beginningless then?
No. And my question would be.
I'm so sorry.
My question.
Well, maybe that's helpful for people who did have the question of beginningless. So what's your question? Given that it's beginningless.
My question would be that because it's beginningless, so it means that it's that is. Because what I don't understand, that if it's beginningless, that is all the time something imprints, is gone. How I basically behaving now with you.
So you mean every
imprint.
Single moment of the mind is doing something in the mind. That's right. Beginninglessly, you've been doing something in the mind.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So in that sense, right now, in that moment, I have
which
all...
Which moment? This moment.
This moment.
Yeah, then.
I have all of that imprints within me right now. So I'm dealing with this kind of karmic imprints now.
Only some have ripened in this life. A tiny few have ripened in this life.
So it means basically that I'm purifying, it means get less and less.
What, darling?
If I purify this kind of imprints, hopefully one day.
No, not hopefully one day, that's superstition.
Yes.
Definitely one day.
So definitely one day it will be purified and it's basically there will be
karmic. That's what we have to understand, purify. So what do you think it means, purify?
Purification for me, it means that if you have, let's say, deluded mind, let's say anger. If you have anger, for example, and you had that imprint, and you use the antidote, let's say love.
Okay, so what finally purifies the anger? What finally removes? So purify means remove.
Remove means, I would say, it's antidote. So if you are using...
So what finally removes the anger from the mind?
I would say compassion or love.
No. Seeing emptiness, realizing emptiness.
Yeah,
okay, let me tell you, this is what we're getting to now. Three reasons to get to emptiness. Kitty's reasons, Helen's reasons, and Erica's reasons. When we understand that all suffering comes from deluded states of mind, deluded states of mind, and then we hear the Buddha says deluded states of mind are adventitious, which means they're not integral to my being, you get that? Which means then that they can be, that means they can be removed, right? We hear that. So then we have to ask the question, what finally removes delusions from my mind? You with me? We have to ask that question, don't we? Well, the answer is when you realize emptiness. So now that we have to look at that logically, what does that mean? And now we're getting to it. This is the point I'm getting at here. What finally removes a deluded conception, a misconception, a wrong view, a wrong interpretation of the way things are, what finally removes that from my mind is the recognition of its absurdity.
That word means, sorry?
Huh?
I don't get that word. What does it mean?
Absurd. Nonsense. How it's just not true. Okay, so like yesterday. All right, okay. I usually like a little example. That's far too big. Never mind, I'll do some weightlifting. Okay, listen.
It's maybe even hot.
So you have in your mind the misconception that this is blue. We talked yesterday.
Yes, yeah.
And you believe it's blue. You've seen it as blue for eons. Yeah. Just remember, all we're doing is using this as an analogy for all the lies in the mind that we've been believing in for eons. That I am self-existent, that mummy made me, that it's not fair, that I'm a victim, that there's no karma, that things are permanent, that delicious cake make me happy, that hungry friends make me ugly. All these lies in our mind, layers upon layers upon layers upon layers of lies in our mind. You get the idea? So here's a simple lie. So we fix your eyes, like we talked yesterday. We fix everything, and then you look again and you get a big shock and you realize it isn't blue any longer, right? And you see it finally as red, don't you? You see it's red. And you now know it's red. So what happened to the thought it's blue? That was a thought in your mind before, wasn't it? What happens to that? What's happened to that thought now? Where's it gone?
Where is it gone?
The thought.
It's changed for red.
No, be more direct. Where has it gone? Does it exist? Does the thought it is blue exist in your mind now?
No.
So it's gone.
Yes.
Disappeared into eternity. Not a fraction left. Nothing left. Gone. Disappeared. Finished. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
And what made it go? What caused
I realized that it's red.
So you saw the truth?
Yes.
So seeing the truth of how things exist is what finally causes all the lies to go.
Okay, I got it.
Yeah. That is the final purification. So we can do the purification practices, which are all they're doing is preventing the negative seeds from growing. We're keeping them under control, doing the conventional purification, the four opponent powers. But finally, it's your insight into the absence of blue here, which eradicates the conception it's blue. Finally, it's the insight into emptiness that from that second, we cannot fall back. From that second, we now are beginning our process of heading towards nirvana. From that second, you're called a superior being, Arya being. So the first direct insight into your seeing directly the absence of the fantasy I, which you believed in for 2 trillion, countless trillions of eons. So it's not as if you have to go back and pull out every seed one at a time, because seeing emptiness is an atomic bomb that will remove them all at once. And this is why when we practice Tantra, just technically, it's the quickest path. It's like the biggest atomic bombs you could ever visualize. Technically, it's the quickest way to rid the mind of the delusions. So it's a practical thing of removing the delusions, because they're adventitious and they can be therefore removed, which is Buddha's amazing, insane, radical point. And we've got to see the logic of this. So then to remove them is where we're heading. As quick as we can. That's why you want to practice Tantra, because it's the quick path.
Okay, all right, thank you.
And that's the final purification.
So it's nice.
You see, Erica?
Yeah, it's clearer, because now even the purifications went back to the right place.
Pardon?
Even the purification.
You speak quicker than me, Erica.
Sorry.
She does, doesn't she?
the purification
she
lights.
She asked me to speak slowly before, so now I have to tell her to speak slowly.
Sorry. That now, even now, the purification.
What, darling?
The purification, now it makes more sense.
Good,
even.
I'm very happy.
So thank you.
Good. So we haven't begun to really talk about emptiness. We just discussed it in general.
Just a quick question. So
a bit closer to the mic, darling. Have it like an ice cream. You're really excited to lick it, you know? Like close.
Following on Erica's comment, then, does
I
that mean...
I can't hear very well. I'm so sorry.
Sorry. Following on Erica's comment, does that mean... So there's no possibility of an imprint left of being having been deluded.
No,
it's
that's
completely
right.
Wiped out.
That's the point. That's the point, dear. Okay. That's what Buddha's saying. That's the whole point. If his methods didn't lead you to remove all the delusions, then you're just going to fall back again and have more suffering. It'll never end. It'll never end. You'll be exhausted. That's Buddha's point.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. I just wondered why there doesn't seem to be anything about bringing regret into your mind in the Tara practice. There was no kind of bringing into mind the remorse or regret for
darling,
past actions.
It's just that way. It's a very simple way. I do just very simple, simple way to. It's not the four opponent powers. It's not like that. It's all subsumed there. It's all assumed there. But it's just a way of doing it to lead it so it's very simple without a sadhana, without all the prayers, without all the dramas. You know, it's a simple way to get a taste of this kind of practice.
That so we could include it in our own.
What, darling?
We could include it in our own practice if we wanted to.
Of course you could.
Would it be helpful?
Of course you could. It's not the way done in the tradition. The best one is to do the four opponent powers and you do use Vajrasattva in the third step. But technically, of course you could. Of course you could, darling. Once you get once you understand the various steps and all this stuff, you can play around with it. You can make your own recipes. Mm. Of course you can. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, darling.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah.
You just said that emptiness is like absolute bodhicitta.
That's one of the terms that's used when you talk in the Mahayana, because emptiness, which is actually itself a Theravadan teaching, is taught in the context of the six perfections of the Bodhisattva. And the term they use to refer to emptiness in that context is they refer to it as ultimate bodhicitta, because emptiness in the context of bodhicitta is said to have so much more power, our insight into it combined with bodhicitta, which is the way it's taught in the Mahayana path.
Okay. So, like, bodhicitta needs to be... if you realize emptiness, the bodhicitta must follow? Or?
No, that doesn't follow at all. No, not at all, not at all. If you're practicing... Okay, if we... Okay, this is why the Lam Rim is so helpful. If you, you know, pick up a book, if you've got this Lam Rim structure, which is where all the Buddha's teachings from A to Z are covered, and you just pick up a and you pick up a book... Well, I can't read it very well. The ink failed, didn't it? Sorry. Better ones. Oh, wonderful. So I just go here, and I go... Don't worry about it. It's okay. If I go... Oh, I have to read my words. I can't find anything. So if I see the word karma... What's your name again?
Lawrence.
Lawrence, okay, thanks, Lawrence. If I read something and I go karma, I'll go, that's junior school, that's first scope. Then I'll go bodhicitta, oh, that's university, that's the great scope. Then I'll go tara, oh, that's postgraduate, that's tantra. Then I'll go, oh, there's emptiness. Well, strictly speaking, emptiness is belonging to high school, to the middle scope. It's a Theravadan teaching. It's a Hinayana teaching itself. Like karma is a Hinayana teaching. The way the mind works and all the delusions, that's Hinayana teachings. And they're all the teachings that a person who is practicing just that needs to get themselves out of samsara. As soon as you hear love, compassion, generosity, bodhicitta, that's a Mahayana teaching. You with me? So emptiness itself is a Theravadan teaching. It's a Hinayana teaching. Meaning, if you're just practicing that path, you're going to graduate at high school. You're going to achieve your own liberation. You're going to control your body and speech, start to meditate, get concentration, know the Buddha's mind, know the Buddha's view of the mind, and then meditate on emptiness, realize emptiness, perfect the realization, and you die, you go into bliss. You're finished, you're done, you're cooked. So emptiness belongs there in itself. Are you with me so far? Lawrence?
Yeah.
I haven't finished yet, but ask your next question.
I kind of get it. So I misunderstood, basically, I guess, that bodhicitta needs to be a part of emptiness.
No, yes, so let me finish. Okay, so now, when we look at the Lam Rim, have you studied the Tibetan Buddhist teachings? Sorry.
I studied. And I was taught differently that in the introduction course, actually, emptiness is not a part of Theravada, it's selflessness, they said.
What, darling?
They said, like, selflessness
is... Who told you this? What's your source for that?
Introduction, teaching? Glenn Svensson and Tushita.
What's your source for that teaching?
Tushita, the introduction course.
But emptiness is not what?
They taught me that, like, this saying, like, that Theravada is selflessness and emptiness is a part of Mahayana.
Oh, rubbish, you didn't hear it right. I would suggest you didn't hear it right, because I'm assuming the teacher's there. Who taught you that? Who was the teacher?
Glenn Svensson.
Who?
Glenn Svensson.
Glenn would not have taught you that. Glenn, I would suggest maybe it was a wrong interpretation. Or may I suggest that? Because selflessness is a term that is, you know, okay, maybe there's different, depending on which interpretation he's using, all right? So can you say more about what he said?
We just had these two lines, and he said, like, that the aspiration of Mahayana is bodhicitta, the aspiration of Theravada.
This one.
I forgot.
It's to want to get out of samsara, renunciation. That's your motivation. If you're on the Theravada path, you want to get out of samsara. So what causes you to get out of samsara? From what you understand. What's the cause of getting out of samsara?
Out of samsara in the end, like finally.
Yeah, for the Theravadan practitioner.
For Theravada practitioner, it was out of samsara? They said like self-realized selflessness, and then
and selflessness
you go into nirvana.
Selflessness of what?
Selflessness of yours, of the I.
And
I
that
guess.
Means another word for selflessness is what?
I never really got the difference.
Word for selflessness is emptiness. What gets you out of samsara is the insight into the absence of the self-existent I. Okay, according to Theravadan teachings, they have different interpretations. There are different interpretations of emptiness, of how things exist. But finally, what gets you out of samsara is the insight into emptiness. That's it. Whether you're whatever you like. So, given that, now that you go to the bodhisattva path, even though emptiness or selflessness, whatever word you prefer, is itself a Theravadan teaching, is itself a Hinayana teaching, where it belongs in Buddha's teachings. But the way it's taught in the Mahayana, it's put into the context of the six perfections of the Bodhisattva, and it's the sixth one. And it's taught, and so the Bodhisattva practitioner, the Bodhisattva, is practicing insight into emptiness combined with bodhicitta. So your insight into emptiness will never, ever, ever, ever bring bodhicitta, and bodhicitta will never, ever, ever, ever bring insight into emptiness, but the two together help each other and bring a very powerful insight into the absence of the inherent I. Together, you need both. A bird needs two wings. So bodhicitta has got its own methods to accomplish it, and then combined with that, you're looking into emptiness on the basis of wanting to become a Buddha for the benefit of sentient beings. It gives it more oomph, more power, it seems. So that's why they these terms. Ultimate bodhicitta is just a term that's used. It's referring to emptiness practiced by the bodhisattva practitioner. Okay? Oh. Okay. What else? I think it's tea time. Then we'll go into dependent arising and emptiness more, and we'll do the Tara practice before lunch. Yeah. Yes, sweetheart.
Yeah, okay. My name is Carmen.
Hello.
Hello. And it is about karma.
Yes.
Being alone.
Being what?
The karma, being alone.
Alone. Alone. No. Yes, no. Yes.
It's difficult to understand. How come it's so unpredictable when it's going to ripen? Or
if it's a law, why is it unpredictable? Well, the simple obvious answer is because you don't know the law enough yet. You're not. If you know that botany is a law. Botany is a law. Would you agree? Botany is the law.
I don't know what botany is. Sorry.
Botany. Tell her in Spanish. What's botany? The law of how flowers grow.
Sorry?
Plants. Tell her what the word is.
Okay, thank you.
It's a law. Would you agree it's a law?
Yes.
So if you just say, oh, botany is a law, but I don't know when everything's going to grow, well, the reason is because you haven't studied it.
Okay.
But it's there for you to study.
Okay.
It's there for you to learn it.
Okay.
You have to learn it, that's all. Mostly now, we don't have any insight into karma at all because we need clairvoyance, because it works at a very subtle level. But the Buddha says you can develop clairvoyance. You just have to get single-pointed concentration, you accomplish karma biding, which is the result of that meditation, and then you will get clairvoyance. Okay. You'll be able to see the past and see the future. Then you can prove it.
Lovely.
But we have to learn it first theoretically, don't we?
Okay, lovely.
Do you understand?
I do.
Because if it isn't a law, you're going to find out.
Yes.
But the reason we can't see it now is because we haven't learned it enough.
Okay.
Do you see the point?
I do. I see.
Good, Carmen.
Thank you.
Why don't we have a tea break, and then we can have more about dependent arising, and we can do the Tara practice. Yeah? Draw your tea, please. See you in 30 minutes, or something like that. Okay.